Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name is Daniel, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Kevin Grange, who is a paramedic, firefighter, works in the national parks, and basically does loads of super cool things. Thanks so much for joining me, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. I'm thrilled to be here today and look forward to a great conversation.
Yeah, no, it should be really, really interesting. And we'll have a chat about a few different things, sort of your journeys around various national parks in America and sort of where you are at the moment. So you're in Jackson Hole at the moment. And just before we were recording, you were saying that sort of as COVID has, it's obviously, it's still here, but as more people are getting vaccines and restrictions are starting to sort of settle a little bit, that there's an overwhelming amount of people keeping you very busy.
Yes, definitely. I think everyone was sort of, you know, cooped up and at home for, you know, the past year and a half or so. And international travel hasn't really picked up. So people are, you know, flocking to the national parks and these mountain towns, and we're seeing the highest visitation. And of course, people don't leave their medical problems at home when they go on vacation. So we've been very busy on the ambulance, and here, you know, we're fairly high elevation at 6,500 feet. So you do have the altitude and the terrain. And what I've noticed is a lot of times when people are on vacation, they take a vacation from their prescriptions. And so they end up here, and, you know, with the altitude and the heat and the dryness, it kind of all combines to present some interesting medical calls.
Definitely. Yes. It's a dangerous combination, isn't it? I suppose a lot of people, they kind of, equate kind of going into the wilderness with sort of finding themselves doing these things. Yeah. Maybe stopping their medication, which is not the best thing if you're further away from medical help than you would be normally, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I think people don't realize that, you know, our closest level one trauma center is in Salt Lake City, which is a 5-hour drive. And our closest level two trauma center is about 2 hours away. So I think, you know, people come from the cities and they're used to that convenience of being surrounded by hospitals, but out here, you know, there's a great hospital in town, but it's, you know, a little bit smaller. So like the higher acuity cardiac or stroke patients or trauma patients, they all have to get shipped out, you know, via helicopter, airplane, or if we can't fly, we have to take them in the ambulance.
Yeah. And it's certainly some good stories about that in your book, which we'll discuss in a little bit, I think. But and I was also looking just sort of before, sort of logging on about that there's rumblings of sort of wildfire smoke warnings not far from where you are.
Yep. Yeah. All across the U.S. is just this incredible heat wave. And so, you know, we're about probably 2 months ahead of where we typically are as far as like the heat and the dryness. And, you know, that's adding a whole nother element. And actually here we have a lot of smoke from fires that are, you know, even a few hundred miles away. So that's kind of adding strain to an already busy 911 system. And we're also finding there's a lot of just short staffing as far as restaurants and businesses around town. And even, you know, with my fire department, which is part volunteer, part full-time folks, you know, people aren't as able to get out on the rescues all the time due to working so much or other things.
Yeah, that makes it tricky, particularly if the sort of absolute number of tourists is higher than usual, and then the workforce is under more strain. And I think it'd be really interesting to sort of, so I know you do lots of different things, but sort of how would your typical week evolve, or like what's the day like in the life of Kevin Grange?
Yeah, great question. The thing I like about working in sort of this rural remote area is no day is the same as the previous one. And our fire department has sort of the all hazards model. And so we're trained on, you know, EMS, we're trained on like structural firefighting, you know, houses. And then we're also trained on wildland firefighting, hazardous material incidents, tactical EMS. So we sort of wear a lot of different hats, which is what makes the job, you know, fun and interesting. So yeah, typical day, you know, we'll probably get a few calls for some tourists who are, you know, at this higher elevation, maybe with some shortness of breath or fatigue. You know, then we'll have some car accidents, and every now and then we have the largest concentration of mammals in the lower 48 states here. So, you know, it could be a motorcyclist versus a bison, or, you know, a car hits an elk, or so you have that human wildlife interaction that, you know, I haven't seen in my previous jobs where I worked in the city.
Yeah, I guess it's not something you'd get through dispatch, is it, sort of thing. But yeah, I guess that kind of goes to show that when we're kind of at that interface of us and nature, there are those extra. It makes your scene safety a lot more important, doesn't it? You don't want to rush in to manage a trauma patient if there's a bear kind of hiding just around the corner.
Yeah. I haven't run that call, but a friend of mine, he went on a grizzly bear mauling, and the bear was still on scene. So they had to have two police officers at the front and back of the gurney with their guns drawn as they took the patient to the ambulance, just in case the bear charged. So what I like to say
stressful.
Is, right. So yeah, out here, it's sort of like you're almost like a ER physician and a little bit of Indiana Jones thrown in. So it's a little bit of everything.
It sounds like it. Your next project will be to train as a vet so you can sort them out as well.
Yeah, exactly.
And I suppose, if we kind of think, rewind a little bit to, I suppose, how you got to where you are. So you've been on an interesting journey through sort of several different national parks. But prior to that, you were working in California, I think, in quite a different role.
Correct. Yeah, I was, you know, working in real estate, and then I was in my mid-30s and, you know, just decided I want a job that had more meaning and that sort of helped people in a more direct way. And at that time, I met a few friends who were EMTs and you know, ER physicians. And I took a wilderness first aid class, which I loved. You know, that was 2 days. And then I signed up for an EMT class. And yeah, the more I explored pre-hospital medicine, the more I fell in love with it. And eventually I went to paramedic school. So following that, I was working in the Los Angeles area. And I liked it, but then, you know, I was at Yosemite National Park in California, and I saw an ambulance drive by, and that was sort of like this light bulb went off, and, you know, sort of like this call to adventure. And I'd never even thought really much of wilderness medicine or paramedics working in national parks. And once I did, that just seemed a great way to blend my two passions of medicine and the outdoors.
Yeah, that's really good. And I suppose because some people think, you know, oh, actually there's a danger of, you know, blending work with, you know, one of your main hobbies and interests and things. But from what you sort of say in your book, that doesn't sort of seem to be the case.
No. And my medical director here, Dr. Will Smith, who's, you know, a hero of mine, he makes a good point that you can be running calls out here at 2 or 3 in the morning, and maybe you're on the side of a mountain or you're doing a river rescue. And he just makes the point that as you're running these stressful calls, you're actually out in this beautiful environment. So you're kind of getting renewed as you're expending all your energy. So you give a lot, but you also receive a lot from living in such a beautiful place. So I thought that was very interesting. And, it helps kind of, you know, prevent burnout that might occur in a city where it's just, you know, call after call and that, you know, concrete environment, and you're not really connecting to the outdoors. So at least for me, that's kind of how I renew myself, you know, spiritually, physically, mentally. So it's a great place to work.
Yeah, that is very good. I think, yeah, there's obviously a huge amount of benefits. And it's, yes, not some of the national parks you've been to, they're not a bad place to sort of have your office and your workplace, are they at all? And yeah, definitely a great way of sort of recharging. And I guess you also meet a lot of sort of similar like-minded characters who are all kind of maybe slightly outside that traditional paradigm of, you know, medicine must exist in a hospital.
Right, yeah. And one definition of wilderness medicine that I love is you're sort of adding a room to the ancient house of medicine. And that's this, you know, new focus on wilderness medicine. And so it's exciting just for me, and I'm sure for you, just how medicine evolves. And, you know, as they say at the World Extreme Medicine Conference, you know, where humankind goes, medicine must follow.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's in, let me get the date right. It's either October or November, isn't it? And fingers crossed, I think you're planning on, are you speaking at it?
I am, yes. It's November 13th through the 15th.
I should know that because I'm also going.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to having, you know, a pint with you. But
definitely.
I'll be talking about a rescue I did in the Himalayan Kingdom of Bhutan.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so
you've written a book about that as well, I think, haven't you?
I have, yeah. That was about a 24-day trek I did in the Himalayas. And the book is about my first time doing the trek, but this rescue actually occurred on the third time I did the trek. A lot of lessons.
Don't tell me about it, because I want to be surprised, and, you know, people listening will also potentially be at the conference, so let's not spoil it for them. But
sure.
Yeah, I look forward to that. I think that would be really good. You went from Los Angeles to Yellowstone was your first place where you started off sort of honing your wilderness medicine skills, wasn't it?
Yeah, Yellowstone, you know, it's the first national park in the world, and it's very remote there. The closest hospital was 2 hours away. So it was definitely a big learning curve for myself.
And I suppose we kind of touched on, obviously, the resources, the extraction times. They're going to be quite different from what you were used to before working in the city. I suppose also, given the environment, I guess much more emphasis on the actual rescue and indeed getting to the patients in the first place.
Yeah, the challenge and the learning curve for me was, in the city, especially Los Angeles, where you're surrounded by hospitals, if you didn't really know what was going on, you could always just, scoop up that patient and race to the nearest ER and kind of let them figure it out. Whereas in Yellowstone, the closest hospital is a couple hours away, and there were clinics in Yellowstone, but, you had to quickly determine, what was going on with the patient, what resources you need, where the best, facility for them to go to. Is it the trauma center? Is it the helicopter or ground? So I really learned a lot of skills, and I guess one skill I learned that I like to say is I feel like as we get all this new technology in medicine, we kind of have lost that art of the hands-on patient assessment.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah.
So in Yellowstone, a lot of times, I'd show up on scene by myself and everyone's listening on the radio. And so I had to quickly determine, what's going on and then what resources I needed, probably in a 1 to 2 minute time frame, and then announce it over the radio and kind of just get the rescue in motion and moving as far as extra personnel, getting a helicopter coming my way, all that type of thing. So it kind of reminded me of just that really good importance of that good hands-on assessment and neuro exam. You can really learn a lot by doing that.
Definitely. And I guess it kind of comes back to one of those kind of mantras, isn't it? It's like, get the basics right, do them well, rather than kind of get carried away by using some sort of technology that might be helpful, but it's kind of the fine print and it's getting that overall impression to start with and things.
Yeah. And of course, technology, maybe the batteries can be out because it's cold, or, you know, it's, I mean, I love technology, but it's, you know, it's good secondary after that good hands-on assessment. And I guess another thing I really learned is transportation is treatment, you know, so getting that patient out of the environment and that extraction is as important a treatment as, you know, starting an IV and giving pain meds.
Yeah, definitely. And there's an interesting story, hearing you mention that from your book. I can't remember which national park it is, but you'll probably know it involves winching a patient out of a car, I think.
Yep, exactly. I think, you know, as you probably know, with another thing with wilderness medicine is there's that element of creativity and improvisation. And, you know, many times your initial plan is going to be like thwarted due to the weather or the terrain. And so it really teaches you to kind of look at your tools creatively. And in that case, the patient was too heavy to carry up the steep hill. So we, you know, connected a winch cable to the backboard, and that kind of provided the strength to pull her up as we lifted. And, you know, we landed a helicopter on the road, but the helicopter couldn't take her due to the weather and the weight. And so again, with wilderness medicine is just always having a backup plan. So as you're planning your ideal rescue, I'll also be planning the contingency plan for when things change.
Yeah, definitely. And probably have a few of them extra ones up your sleeve, isn't it? I liked the term in your book, pumpkin time, when it's too, you know, too dark for the helicopters to come out, depending on what equipment they've got in them. I thought that was a good one.
Yep. Yeah. And then here in Jackson, we'll fly out a lot of people from, you know, the local airport. And, some of the pilots, I think when it's snowing, they have this test where if they can't, you know, blow the snow off the wing just with their breath, they can't fly. And so I've been, you know, just there with a patient having a huge heart attack and, you know, watching the pilot do these final checks and just kind of praying, like, please be able to take this patient. And so, yeah, a lot of times it comes down to just these very critical minutes. And minutes matter, you know, because maybe that snow is starting to build up on the wing and you're not able to fly. And now it's a 2-hour transport in the ambulance in the middle of a snowstorm.
Yeah, it's difficult. I suppose, and it's not like kind of getting, you know, the emotion and, you know, the medical need of the, you know, this patient who's having a massive heart attack. We need to take off in that plane and then actually causing a greater risk to all of you, you know, by doing it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a good point. Just to, you know, remember that, you know, it's the patient matters, but also, yeah, you could potentially be putting the lives of all the rescuers in danger as well.
Yeah, definitely. An important theme there, isn't it? And I suppose out of sort of, you know, there's a lot of interesting cases that I'm sure that you've been involved with. Are there any that particularly sort of stand out, you know, in terms of making an impression on you or having, you know, particular significance, do you think?
Yeah, sure. There's two. Well, one thing I love about working in sort of a rural remote area is you have that autonomy to make your own decisions. And then as far as like the treatment algorithms, you have so much time with the patient that you really get to practice medicine. You get to kind of go down the full treatment algorithm. Whereas in a city, again, the transport times are so short. A lot of times you only have time to start an IV and maybe just give one treatment. Whereas out here, say an allergic reaction, you can give the epi, the Benadryl, the steroid, maybe a breathing treatment. So it's really fun that you kind of really get to use all of your protocols. So as far as a couple calls, one, I just like to tell this story because I'm sure a lot of, you know, listeners are working in sort of austere environments and maybe with search and rescue teams is, we were on a 2-day search for a gentleman that disappeared in Yosemite National Park in California. And, you know, it had been raining and cold. So we found him 2 days later and, you know, he had battle signs, bruising around his eyes, kind of suggestive of like a basilar skull fracture. And he was still, you know, he was probably about a GCS 10 when we found him. But as we got him in the ambulance, his, you know, he just started to crash and, you know, went down to like a GCS of 3. And, you know, so I was just, when I learned this, I'm just like, or when I was running the call, I was just thinking, hey, he should be improving now that he's in this warm ambulance and with EMS. And I guess what I learned with that call is the moment we arrive can actually be the most dangerous for the patient because they've kind of been holding on and that, you know, that sympathetic nervous system's firing. And then we show up and the patient kind of gives up and there's that just crash where, you know, maybe he stops trying so hard. And again, you have almost like a reversal of that sympathetic nervous system that was keeping him alive. And so I like to tell, you know, search and rescue folks that, yeah, the moment you get to these patients, you know, a good thing to say is like, hey, we're here, you know, the worst is over, but you got to keep working with us and don't give up now because, you know, you do have that almost like after drop phenomenon, you know, with the vital signs. Yeah. So that was a very interesting case for me.
You know, that is interesting. And I think it's easy to sort of get almost, you know, when you come to a patient in that kind of situation, it's easy to kind of get distracted by the medicine, you know, and get task focused on things that you need to do, whether it's your assessment and forget that, you know, they're a human, and actually keeping, you know, that communication going, as you say, is so important, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And then another one that was very interesting to me was, you know, there's a time and place to practice medicine, but there's also a time and place maybe not to. And the call that sort of comes to mind was a Japanese visitor at Yellowstone in his 90s presented with, you know, a AAA and some ST elevation on the monitor. And, you know, naturally we wanted to do everything we could and, you know, call a helicopter, but he was sort of at the end of his life on, you know, hospice care, and he just wanted to spend the day seeing the geysers of Yellowstone. And so that kind of reminded me of that great book, Being Mortal by Dr. Atul Gawande, that, you know, sometimes in medicine, our job is, you know, not to do more medicine. It's just to sort of support the patient and, you know, what makes life meaningful for them. And so with this patient and his kids were actually doctors as well. He didn't want all these medical interventions. He just wanted to spend this day with his family and watch the geysers. And I thought that was just a good reminder that ultimately we're here to support the patient, you know, in whatever's best for them and, you know, how they want to live their lives.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's a really powerful story, isn't it? And because it's very easy to, just say, look, you need to do this. And, you know, you can imagine those discussions, isn't it? You sort of go through, well, you know, you may die if you refuse treatment, get everyone to sign the forms, and you're kind of forgetting, actually, you know, the overall experience. And you've got to be an advocate for your patient and things, don't you? And I think, that's a really, really nice story.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, just whether you're on that call or any type of call, working in the national parks, and a lot of times the medicine side of the call was, you know, you do those initial treatments and then the medicine's almost done for a fair amount of the time. And so after that, it's just making a connection with your patient. And I guess I like to say it kind of taught me that the healing power of hope, you know, with the patients and making that personal connection, which, you know, can decrease their anxiety, which in turn decreases that workload on the heart. And so the human element in medicine, I was reminded of that, you know, just always make that connection with the patient.
Definitely. Yeah. That's so important. And then, obviously once you've sort of done a bit of, you know, paramedic work, you then decided to kind of sidestep, well, continue your paramedic work, but then also kind of train in fire service.
Yeah, I think a lot of that's because, you know, we are very isolated here in Jackson Hole and in the national parks. So we do have to kind of wear that all hazards hat. And, you know, there's pretty much just us. And so whether it's a wildland fire or house fire, we're pretty much it. So we have to kind of know how to respond to all those different emergencies.
And is it usually a case that you'd go to a call and you'd be like, okay, today I'm wearing my firefighter hat and someone else is doing the paramedic stuff? Or is it a case you turn up, do what you need to do to sort of triage patients and then sort of grab the hose and put the fire out? How does it normally work?
Well, it's always evolving. And so I think, you know, generally, like I'm on shift tomorrow, and if it's a medical call, we'll hop on the ambulance. And then if it's a fire call, like a fire alarm, we'll all hop on the fire engine. If it's a huge call, yesterday, for instance, a boat flipped over in the Snake River and four people, you know, were washed away, and one woman unfortunately passed away. So depending on the call and what volunteer response we get, as far as people showing up, that kind of dictates. But ultimately, if it's a medical call, they're going to want the highest level provider, which is us as a paramedic. And then also our medical directors, Dr. Will Smith and Dr. AJ Wheeler, they often show up on the calls as well. Like Dr. Smith was on the call yesterday. And so that's, you know, just a huge benefit to our community, but also to us paramedics, that we have that, you know, emergency physician on scene that we can work with and, you know, seek advice from. So that's a unique thing that we have here in Jackson Hole.
Yeah, that's really useful, isn't it? And I suppose on a personal level, what have you sort of found the most challenging sort of thing to do with, you know, those two roles and things that you've come across that have maybe been a bit harder than you thought they'd be?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the more skills you do, like in a city, if you're with the fire department, you might just be like, hey, you're the guy to throw the ladders, or you're the guy to do the ventilation on the roof. So you can really specialize in that one skill. Whereas here, I think one of the hardest parts is we wear so many different hats that it can be challenging to maintain proficiency in everything. And during this busy summer, you know, we always want to train, but we're actually kind of running the calls. So we might not have time. So I think the proficiency with all these different hats that we wear is a challenge, a fun one. And then holistically looking at the whole career, I do think, you know, over time and, you know, seeing just sort of the tragic and traumatic things that we see, all EMS providers and doctors just have to have sort of that awareness of, you know, the operational and like psychological first aid, just because, you know, PTSD is a real thing and it affects us. So I think that's been a challenging part for me, but I've also found, you know, ways that work for me to kind of run the calls and then move beyond the calls just to stay ready for the next call.
Yeah, that's a really important thing, isn't it? And I guess it's something that there's certainly much more awareness of now. I think people are, you know, they're more willing to kind of talk about it and things. It's probably, you know, I think it is still a stigma, certainly over here. You know, people aren't so open about things as maybe they should be. But I think, yeah, having that awareness of actually, you know, that case affected me. You don't want to just put them all in boxes and then have those boxes sort of explode somewhere in your head at a later date, isn't it? You need to have some sort of way of decompressing or some sort of coping mechanisms, like you say.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, luckily here, you know, I love the outdoors. So that's, you know, the best thing for me after a tough call is like to get out and hike and mountain bike or do something like that. And I do feel here it's kind of harder because a lot of times people have these tragedies while they're on vacation. So, you know, they're here for a wedding, or they're here with, you know, multiple generations, grandparents, parents, kids, and it's a great family memory. But, you know, when these tragic things happen, it almost kind of hits harder just because, you know, everyone's having such a great time before it happens.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I suppose it's like, yes, a juxtaposition of sort of like, you know, going into the wilderness, seeing these amazing views, having an amazing experience, but then, yeah, I suppose we're all only so far away from something happening and you can't really tell. Yeah, must make it quite tricky. And I suppose we're kind of coming towards the end of the episode sort of now, but I think it would be really interesting to sort of hear what advice you have for people who are kind of thinking of sort of similar careers, whether that is in the US or elsewhere, what kind of advice that you'd have for them?
Yeah, great question. Well, I know some of us find medicine first and then they find adventure second. And I know some of your previous guests, they found adventure first, then went into medicine, or maybe they found medicine first. So I just, you know, I love the quote by Joseph Campbell, which is follow your bliss. And so, you know, just knowing you can create the kind of life you want in medicine and find out, you know, where your passions lie. And then I really believe in like finding good mentors and, you know, like my medical directors, Dr. Will Smith, Dr. AJ Wheeler, and just learning from them and, you know, just following up on the opportunities. And I think always to keep growing as well. I think that's probably the advice I'd suggest.
Yeah, I like that quote. I hadn't heard that one before. It's definitely one that's worth hanging on to, isn't it? And I suppose, so what are your plans for the future, sort of the next little while?
Well, you know, mainly just keep working here. And as you mentioned, my book Wild Rescues was recently published and I just got married in February. So I'm kind of just...
Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think my wife will hopefully be coming over to Scotland for the World Extreme Medicine Conference as well. And nice. She's a firefighter EMT and she's also like a heli ski guide.
All you guys doing all these cool things. It's really amazing.
Yeah. So I'm just, you know, I don't have any huge plans. You know, I might try to guide the snowman trek in Bhutan in 2022.
Nice.
Yeah. So, you know, nothing huge planned, just enjoying, you know, working here and, you know, just kind of living in the present, I guess. But I'm sure I'll be doing some different things, you know, coming up here soon.
It's definitely important to live in the present. And yeah, your book is available on Amazon or through your own website, which is kevingrange.com, isn't it?
It is, yes. And it's also available as an audiobook.
Fantastic.
So. Yeah.
We'll put some links in the episode description for all of those. And I guess for people who are maybe not so medically and they're just listening sort of for fun, what advice do you think, you know, based on your experiences, your works with the National Park Service, I guess what kind of preventative advice do you, you know, in a nutshell, do you think they should have?
Sure, yeah. I think one great piece of advice that seems small but plays a huge part in the rescues is definitely let friends and family know what your itinerary is. So I like to, you know, let someone know who's staying behind. And then I also will write up the itinerary and put it in my windshield. So if you do ever fail to return, people know where to kind of initiate that search. And then just being very respectful of the environment, you know, carrying the 10 essentials of hiking, such as extra food, extra clothes, you know, some form of illumination or a headlamp. And, you know, never underestimating the environment that, you know, hey, that snowstorm might come up in the middle of summer or, you know, just being aware of lightning, just kind of having that good situational awareness.
Yeah, that's definitely really important. Do you find a lot of people sort of venture into the parks quite unprepared?
I do, yeah. And I think, you know, a lot of times it's people's first trip into the park. And I know for me, a lot of what I pack in my backpack, it's there because I learned through trial and error. You know, I've been on that hike where I ran out of water and didn't have a water filtration system with me. So I kind of learned through the school of hard knocks, but a lot of people, you know, they've just never been into the outdoors in this capacity. And so they don't know about, you know, bringing the extra water or the extra clothes and that type of thing.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess the other side of it is the leaving no trace. Certainly in our national parks, obviously a lot smaller than yours in the UK, but it's always lots of people, particularly post-COVID, just coming and sort of leaving their mark, as it were, you know, face masks everywhere, and it's really frustrating.
Sure. Yeah. That's a great one. You know, just, you know, here a lot of times people want to cut, if it's like a switchback, they'll want to cut the trail, and, you know, then there ends up being a lot of social trails or, So yeah, I love that reminder just to leave no trace, you know, take nothing but memories and then leave no trace.
Exactly. That's it. Well, awesome. It's been really good to chat. We could probably chat for a few more hours, couldn't we? But it's been really interesting. And yeah, we'll definitely look forward to having a few beers or similar up in Edinburgh. I think that'd be excellent.
Yeah, I look forward to it. And again, thank you very much for having me on. And can't wait to meet up in Scotland in November.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.